Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 247, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on August 27th of the year 2000, and we're going to kick right in with an article about the Unification Church. That's an organization that I've discussed in the past as being an extension of the Japanese Patriotic and Ultranationalist Societies, the occult-slash-intelligence-slash-organized-crime institutions that helped to bring fascism to Japan. There's a Miscellaneous Archive show about Japanese fascism that discusses the Patriotic and Ultranationalist Societies, and I've discussed the Moon Organization as an extension of those societies in Radio Free America program number 7, Radio Free America program number 14, and I've discussed George Bush, that's George Herbert Walker Bush, or George Sr., doing speeches for the Moon Organization after his departure from the White House, that in For the Record program number 84, all of those available from Spitfire. This is an organization that discusses the Unification Church in the context of its growing acceptance and its growing economic and political power. And bear in mind that this organization, although nominally Korean and with strong links to the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, is at its foundation a Japanese-slash-fascist organization, and its seminal and most influential members were Japanese fascists, many of them war criminals interned by the United States, initially at least after World War II, individuals such as Roichi Sasakawa and Yoshio Kodama discussed in RFA Program 7 and 14. Bear in mind the organization's strong links to the former World Anti-Communist League. This article is from the San Jose Mercury News of Saturday, August 19th of the year 2000. This is an article by Ben Raines. It's datelined Bayou Labatra, or Labater, Alabama. It's headlined Moon Over Bayou, subtitled The Unification Church Has Turned Around Negative Public Perceptions Through Business Savvy and Its Community Outreach. I would note here, before we get into this, among the recent acquisitions by the Unification Church, as noted in For the Record Program 243, is United Press International. Talking about the Unification Church's acceptance and change of image and its growing political and economic power, Ben Raines writes in the Mercury of 8/19/2000, as evidence of the change, they point to claims of a growing worldwide membership in the millions, church members elected to state legislatures in the United States, and a global network of businesses including hotels, newspapers, radio and TV stations, car plants, restaurants, and magazines such as Golf Digest. And one of the first examples of the church's new place in the world is here in Bayou Labatra. Unificationists run several of the town's largest and most successful businesses. Their shipbuilding company does repair work for the U.S. Coast Guard and Navy. I would note that the Defense Intelligence Agency, among other institutions in the 1970s, noted the Unification Church's alien origins, and by that I don't mean space aliens, and listed it as a threat to U.S. national security. So please note the Unification Church's growing economic and political power, and note the observations of the DIA, among other U.S. intelligence agencies, that it could represent a threat to U.S. national security, this despite the fact that other elements of U.S. intelligence work with the Unification Church. And speaking of foreign threats to U.S. national security and growing infiltration of the U.S. economic and political infrastructure and implications of that, the following article is from the Wall Street Journal of Thursday, August 24th of the year 2000. It talks about the FBI's involvement with some of the mergers that are taking place in the telecommunications field, specifically some of the national security implications of allowing companies, foreign companies, and in particular foreign companies controlled by foreign governments, to buy into the U.S. telecommunications market. The McDonald discuss here is Special Agent Alan McDonald. That, of course, is capital M-C, capital D-O-N-A-L-D. He is the FBI special agent in charge of helping to regulate some of these merger talks, and I would note in a positive sense, apparently Agent McDonald has considerable influence with regard to scotching some of these telecommunications deals that do not measure up to national security implications. Whether his power is sufficient and whether those safeguards will turn out to be sufficient remains to be determined. In this context, I would note something in passing and something we've noted Most recently, in For the Record program number 245, Deutsche Telekom über alles, that Deutsche Telekom, with a controlling interest owned by the German government, is now buying into the U.S. telecommunications market, and note that the son of Helmut Kohl's former chief of staff, Andreas Strassmeier, was, according to Carol Howe, an ATF informant who passed a polygraph examination, the mastermind of the Oklahoma City bombing, and that Timothy McVeigh, among others, was his protege. In that context, note the following, again from the Wall Street Journal of Thursday, August 24th of the year 2000. This is an article by Neil King Jr. and David S. Cloud, spelled just like in cloud. It's entitled, Hang-ups, Global Phone Deals Face Scrutiny from New Source, the FBI, subtitled, Even without his weapons, Special Agent McDonald calls shots in merger talks, and the article deals again with Special Agent Alan McDonald. About McDonald's role in telecommunications mergers, we read, skipping down, Since a 1996 law deregulated the U.S. telecommunications business, Mr. McDonald and the FBI have elbowed their way into nearly every big deal involving foreign and U.S. telecommunications companies. Their mission, preserve the FBI's decades-old snooping capacity, and safeguard the country from foreign spies. Now, an agency known for chasing mobsters and dueling with drug cartels is playing spoiler in the global telecommunications business. As the industry has grown in recent years, so too has electronic surveillance by federal authorities. State and federal courts approved 2,236 so-called intercepts last year, up from 1,309 a decade ago. Today's drug smugglers and terrorists have more ways than ever to communicate, including satellite phones, pagers, and email. Such services are now being offered by companies in Great Britain, Canada, Japan, and other foreign nations, complicating the task of surveillance. The FBI's worries go beyond chasing criminals. The agency also fears that foreigners could use control of phone networks in the U.S. to eavesdrop on business conversations and steal trade secrets. FBI officials also worry that foreign companies might work on behalf of their own country's intelligence services, using U.S. networks to channel information back home. And skipping down, lately the FBI extended its regulatory reach to the Internet, holding up Nippon Telephone and Telegraph Company's $5.5 billion offer to acquire U.S. Internet web hosting company Verio Incorporated until a Japanese buyer agreed to strict national security safeguards. And we're going to ruminate about this article in just a second, but more about the NTT Verio purchase, and people are going to learn something very, very interesting about NTT, skipping down in the story. Negotiations with NTT delayed the merger for nearly 3 months as the FBI pushed to assure that the Japanese government, which owns 53% of NTT, would have no role in Verio's day-to-day operations or involvement in wiretapping Verio's network. The agency also demanded, and the companies agreed to, a variety of restrictions on who could have access within Verio to federal wiretapping information. The next likely subject for FBI scrutiny, Deutsche Telekom's proposed purchase of VoiceStream, which has caused more anxiety in the U.S. than any previous global deal. I would note in passing, first of all, that one is certainly not going to, or one should not excuse any abuses by the FBI or any other federal intelligence agency, and certainly abuses have occurred in the past. Nonetheless, it is absolutely essential that the FBI have the power to conduct wiretaps and electronic surveillance. Just as in the past, I have defended and ardently defended the Menwith Hill / Echelon network of the National Security Agency and GCHQ as absolutely essential to U.S. and British national security, abuses notwithstanding, and there have certainly been abuses. So too, the FBI surveillance network, including its recently publicized carnivore email snooping capability, is also essential to national security and should be ardently defended by those who are sincerely patriotic and democratic with a small d. Nonetheless, one should not excuse any abuses by federal intelligence or police agencies. I think, sadly, that the answer to preventing those abuses is not a simple one. I don't think it's realistic for people to expect to have a just intelligence service or a just federal police agency in an unjust and corrupt society. And I think the long-term solution to eliminating abuses is to reform the society in and of itself. That is not going to be an easy or a quick task, and it's one to which people should apply themselves, and one which is going to take, in all likelihood, generations if it is ever accomplished at all. Nonetheless, is claiming that Men with Hill Echelon should not be conducting worldwide electronic surveillance, or that the FBI's carnivore capability should be compromised, is not only a misplaced sentiment, but a very foolish and, in my opinion, over the long term, self-destructive one as well. Again, that should not be misinterpreted as in any way excusing abuses of federal power. Speaking of abuses of federal power, the Wen-Ho Lee alleged spying case, and note my claims and my choice of words in that regard, has been in the news for some months and has been a political football by the Republican Party. Things are not as they have been represented in many of the mainstream media. I want to note in that regard the fine work that's been done on the Wen-Ho Lee case by syndicated columnist Robert Scheer, last name S-C-H-E-E-R. Robert Scheer writes for the Los Angeles Times and is editor of USC's Online Journalism Review. In the San Francisco Examiner of Friday, August 25th of the year 2000, Robert Scheer had a column that was entitled FBI's Inadvertent False Testimony in Lee Case, and inadvertent is in quotes. This article is Dateline Santa Monica, and the column reads in part as follows, skipping down. Last week at a bail hearing for Lee, who has been held in solitary confinement since December under unusually cruel conditions, an FBI agent testified that he had, quote, inadvertently, unquote, misled the judge on crucial aspects of the case. Among them was that Lee had failed a lie detector test, which in fact he passed with very high marks, that Lee failed to disclose a 1980s meeting with Chinese scholars, which he'd reported to his superiors at the time, and that Lee had lied to a Los Alamos colleague about his purpose in downloading files, despite a grand jury record to the contrary. The panoply of false testimony offered by the prosecution 8 months ago had convinced a federal judge that Lee's, quote, deeply troubling, unquote, deceptions justified imprisoning Lee in a small cell without the possibility of visitors or bail, skipping down. On Thursday, the judge reversed his decision and ruled that Lee should be released from his Santa Fe jail cell on $1 million bail and sent home to Los Alamos under house arrest until his trial. Note the many abuses. First of all, that Lee had passed a lie detector test that he was reported to have failed, that he failed, unquote, to disclose a 1980s meeting with Chinese scholars, which he reported to his superiors at the time, and that he had lied to a Los Alamos colleague about his purpose in downloading files, despite the fact that a grand jury knew otherwise. Note also that a judge recently reversed field with regard to Wen-Ho Lee's bail. What has not received the publicity due it is one of the reasons why the judge reversed his field. Most media voices have not reported what I am about to relate to you. This comes from the San Jose Mercury News of Friday, August 11th of the year 2000. This is an article by Dan Stober, S-T-O-B-E-R, of the Mercury News. It's headlined, Earlier Cooperation with CIA May Aid Lee's Defense Efforts. Note the following, subtitled Ruling, Judge Allows Scientists' Lawyers to Use Classified Information from Intelligence Agencies' Files. The article reads in part, For many years, Wen-Ho Lee and his wife Sylvia quietly aided the CIA, the FBI, and the Department of Energy, sometimes supplying information about Chinese nuclear weapons scientists. Now that cooperation may pay off for Lee, the former Los Alamos National Laboratory weapons scientist awaiting trial in Albuquerque on charges of mishandling classified computer files. U.S. District Court Judge James Parker has ruled that the intelligence agency's files contain information that runs contrary to the prosecutor's allegation that Lee acted with the intent to harm the United States or aid a foreign country when he downloaded the nuclear weapons files to portable data tapes. I would note that he was apparently doing so because he was going to have to go looking for a job since the laboratory's staff was being cut due to budgetary restrictions. There are a number of possibilities in light of the apparent cooperation between Lee and the FBI and the CIA and the Department of Energy in the past. One, of course, is that the Republican congressional delegation and perhaps the Bush faction of the intelligence community, aware of Wenho Lee's work on behalf of U.S. intelligence, was simply attempting to play the race card in anticipation of an upcoming presidential race. I think that is the greatest of the possibilities. The possibility of interagency rivalry also is something that needs to be considered. There are rivalries between not only intelligence services, but between factions of intelligence services, and note that there are several involved in the background of Wenho Lee. The Wenho Lee case is falling apart very rapidly. It'll be interesting to see if the Republicans who led the charge against Wenho Lee wind up cleansing what they have already sullied. It'll also be interesting to see if this has any effect on the Asian American vote in the upcoming presidential elections. It is certainly very, very interesting indeed, and it'll be interesting to see ultimately what is the disposition of the Wenho Lee case is in light of not only the evidence of his innocence, but in light of the fact that he was basically doubled on by elements of the U.S. intelligence when he had worked for U.S. intelligence. I would also note that he was born in Taiwan, and at last count, last observation, the Taiwanese were not getting along that well with the Chinese communists, and obviously I'm being sarcastic under the circumstances. Speaking of intelligence agencies and abuses by same, one thing that I never expected to see in even as relatively progressive a publication as The Nation magazine was hands-on discussion of the intelligence community's mind control programs, other than the usual stuff about, well, they did a little CIA experimentation. Although this article that I'm about to read stops way short of what it could have discussed, it still represents something of a step forward in terms of the progressive, or as I like to call them generally, the quote progressive unquote media's acknowledgement of long evident truths. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who researched this from The Nation magazine. This comes from The Nation's issue of December 20th of the year 1999. This article is by Paul Robeson, Jr., and this is about his father, Paul Robeson, Sr., an American pioneer in the field of civil rights, the first black All-American football player, and a singer of and performing artist of considerable note. Paul Robeson also was, for much of his political career, a doctrinaire Marxist, and as such was subject to the abuses of the Cold War and the McCarthy period, and may have been a victim of elements of U.S. intelligence and even some of the intelligence community's mind control programs. That certainly is the question being asked here by Paul Robeson Jr. in this article from The Nation of 12-20-99 entitled The Paul Robeson Files, and it reads as follows. On the morning of March 27th, 1961, Paul Robeson was found in the bathroom of his Moscow hotel suite after having slashed his wrists with a razor blade following a wild party that had raged there the preceding night. His blood loss was not yet severe and he recovered rapidly. However, both the raucous party and his, quote, suicide attempt remain unexplained, and for the past 20 years the U.S. government has withheld documents that I believe hold the answer to the question, was this a drug-induced suicide attempt? Heavily censored documents I have already received under the Freedom of Information Act confirm that my father was under intense surveillance by the FBI and CIA in 1960 and 61 because he was planning to visit China and Cuba in violation of U.S. passport restrictions. The FBI files also reveal a suspicious concern over my father's health beginning in 1955. A meeting I had in 1998 adds further grounds for suspicion. In June of that year, I met Dr. Eric Olson in New York, and we were both struck by the similarities between the cases of our respective fathers. On November 28, 1953, Olson's father, Dr. Frank Olson, a scientist working with the CIA's top-secret MK-Ultra mind control program, allegedly, quote, jumped, unquote, through the glass of a 13th-floor hotel window and fell to his death. CIA documents have confirmed that a week earlier, Olson had been surreptitiously drugged with LSD at a high-level CIA meeting. It is expected that a New York grand jury will soon reveal whether it believes Olson was murdered by the CIA because of his qualms about the work he was doing. MK-Ultra poisoned foreign and domestic, quote, enemies, unquote, with LSD to induce mental breakdown and or suicide. Olson's drugging suggested a CIA motive similar to the possible one in my father's case, concerned about the target's planned course of action. I would note that the CIA and other intelligence services' mind control programs go incalculably beyond what is discussed in this particular story, and more than one step beyond, I would note. The Moon Organization has also been reported by many to have engaged in mind control programs of somewhat different nature. Continuing. In this context, the fact that Richard Helms was CIA Chief of Operations at the time of my father's 1961, quote, suicide attempt, unquote, has sinister implications. Helms was also responsible for the MKUltra program. In 1967, a former CIA agent to whom I promised anonymity told me in a private conversation that my father was a subject of high-level concern and that Helms and Director of Central Intelligence Alan Dulles discussed him in a meeting in 1955. The events leading to my father's, quote, suicide attempt, unquote, began when, alarmed by intense surveillance in London, he departed abruptly for Moscow alone. His intention was to visit Havana at Fidel Castro's personal invitation and return home to join the civil rights movement. Since the date set by the CIA for the Bay of Pigs invasion fell only 4 weeks after his arrival in Moscow, the CIA had a strong motive for preventing his travel to Havana. My father manifested no depressive symptoms at the time, and when my mother and I spoke to him in the hospital soon after his, quote, suicide, unquote, attempt, he was lucid and able to recount his experience clearly. The party in his suite had been imposed on him under false pretenses by people he knew, but without the knowledge of his official hosts. By the time he realized this, his suite had been invaded by a variety of anti-Soviet people whose behavior had become so raucous that he locked himself in his bedroom. His description of that setting, I later came to learn, matched the conditions prescribed by the CIA for drugging an unsuspecting victim, and the physical/psychological symptoms he experienced matched those of an LSD trip. My Russian being fluent, I confirmed my father's story by interviewing his official hosts, his doctors, the organizers of the party, several attendees, and a top Soviet official. However, I could not determine whether my father's blood tests had shown any trace of drugs, whether an official investigation was in progress, or why his hosts were unaware of the party. The Soviet official confirmed that known, quote, anti-Soviet people, unquote, had attended the party. By the time I returned to New York in early June, my father appeared to me to be fully recovered. However, when my parents returned to London several weeks later, my father became anxious, and he and my mother returned to Moscow. There, his well-being was again restored, and in September they once more went back to London, where my father almost immediately suffered a relapse. My mother, acting on ill-considered advice of a close family friend, allowed a hastily recommended English physician to sign my father into the Priory Psychiatric Hospital near London. My father's records from the Priory, which I obtained only recently, raised the suspicion that he may have been subjected to the CIA's MKUltra mind depatterning, unquote, technique, which combined massive electroconvulsive therapy with drug therapy. On the day of his admission, my mother was pressured into consenting to ECT, and the treatment began just 36 hours later. In May of 1963, I learned that my father had received 54 ECT treatments, and I arranged his transfer to a clinic in East Berlin. Certain key CIA documents that have been withheld in whole or in part would probably shed additional light on these events. That again from the Nation of 12-20-99, and a tip of the hat on that goes to a listener, and a tip of the hat on the following also goes to a member of the listening audience. This comes from the Counterpunch newsletter of Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair. Specifically, this comes from the Counterpunch issue of May 1st through 15th of the year 2000. This is an article by Marta Russell, R-U-S-S-E-L-L, headlined $50,000 for Killer Doc. This is about a humanitarian award that was given to Jack Kevorkian, the killer doctor, awarded by some interesting people on the panel, and I've noted the Right to Die movement and its philosophical and political connections to the euthanasia program, which gave rise to Nazi genocide. This also, by the way, may hold the key to the future of medical care if we are not careful. This article is entitled $50,000 for Killer Doc. It's by Marta Russell and reads in part as follows. Jack Kevorkian and death row lawyer Brian Stevenson both received the humanist Gleitzman Foundation Citizen Activist Award in Cambridge on April 10th. The dual award this year was post-ironic. Kevorkian, whose book Prescription Medicide, unquote, advocates live medical experimentation on death row inmates and the harvesting of their organs, shared the $100,000 award with Equal Justice Initiative and founder executive director Brian Stevenson, who was rightly recognized for his career-long fight against the death penalty. Skipping down, the authors note that among the judges was feminist Gloria Steinem, whose CIA connections I detailed in Miscellaneous Archive Show M4. Skipping down, we read, disabled activist group Not Dead Yet explained that in the late 1950s, Kevorkian wrote articles, lobbied legislators, and contacted death row prisoners proposing that death row inmates be offered a, quote, choice, unquote. A difficult execution by whatever means the state offered, or an easy execution by means of general anesthesia. There was one catch. In Kevorkian's plan, death would not be immediate. Rather, the anesthesia would be given at a sublethal dose while surgical procedures and experiments would be carried out on the, quote, patient, unquote. After the hours or days needed to complete the experiment, if the patient was still alive, the dosage would be increased to lethal levels. Realizing that he would not win the right to perform live human experimentation and organ harvesting on death row inmates, Kevorkian moved on to a group he perceived as easier targets, people with disabilities. Kevorkian states that public acceptance of assisted suicide and euthanasia is an essential first step in advancing his agenda of experimenting on living people and extracting their organs. Further investigation by Not Dead Yet disclosed that in a medical journal article, The Last Fearsome Taboo, Medical Aspects of Planned Death, Kevorkian again outlined these gruesome goals in connection with death row prisoners, as well as adults with Alzheimer's and babies with spina bifida. Skipping down again, researchers at Wayne State University found that over 70% of the people who have died in Kevorkian's hands were not terminally ill. Janet Adkins, who had recently been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, was reported to have played tennis the week before her appointment with Kevorkian. Judith Curran had chronic fatigue, was depressed, and had filed domestic abuse charges against her husband 2 weeks before her killing. Skipping down, is it humanist or even defensible to be willing to step in and, quote, help, unquote, an obviously depressed 43-year-old woman in her death when she was diagnosed with MS, non-terminal, and then abandoned by a husband who also took her children? That is what Kevorkian did to the vulnerable Sherry Miller, who needed antidepressants and a good lawyer, but not a visit with Kevorkian. Is it humanist to assist a quadriplegic, non-terminal, to his death? Do a botched job taking out his kidneys and then dump him at a hospital doorstep? That is what Kevorkian and or his associates did to Joseph Tushkowski. The Oakland County's medical examiner called Tushkowski's body, quote, a scene from a slaughterhouse, unquote. No doubt this was practice for the organ harvesting scheme. Is it humanist to assist in the suicide of a disabled man who has been waiting for 9 agonizing months for a wheelchair from his horrible HMO? That is what Kevorkian did to Matt Johnson. Johnson's wheelchair came the day after Kevorkian's visit, one day too late to free him from his seemingly permanent bedridden state and the actual permanent state of death. Skipping down again, Kevorkian's written statement to court, August 1990, cited in a State of Michigan versus Kevorkian Circuit Court for the County of Oakland, makes his intent much clearer. He wrote, quote, the voluntary self-elimination of individual and mortally diseased or crippled lives taken collectively can only enhance the preservation of public health and welfare, unquote. That concludes For the Record 247, being recorded on August 27th of the year 2000. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.